Even after the defeat of Omnius, Raina Butler had continued her anti-technology movement, which was then called the Cult of Serena. After launching her crusade when she was just a girl, having miraculously survived the machine plagues that killed her whole family, Raina never swerved from her mission, until an assassin's bomb killed her at the age of 97. The CET riots were an added flashpoint to her followers. The uproar against the Orange Catholic Bible was not precisely the same as Raina's desire to stifle technology, but the two movements had similar goals. Raina Butler had been old, but still sharp and charismatic, and she had not relied on medical technology, or melange, or drugs. She had lived to such a great age, because she was pure. Manford had joined the Butlerians as an enthusiastic, idealistic 15-year-old after running away from home. He knew that the machines had wiped out the population on his family's home planet long ago, and even though Omnius and the Cymex had been defeated decades before his birth, Manford still held a grudge. He was an impassioned young man who wanted to fight long after the battles had ended. Fitting in among the Butlerians, he loved being close to Raina, listening to her, watching her. He adored her like a student with a crush on a teacher, admiring the sparkle and gleam in her eyes, the radiance of her ivory-pale skin. Although she had lost all of her hair as a child due to the machine-induced plague, Manford still saw immense beauty in her. She had noticed him among all her followers. Once, she even told Manford that she expected great things from him. When he gave the embarrassed response that he was much too young to become a real leader, Raina answered, "I was only 11 when I received my calling." As the fledgling Imperium expanded, there were those who resisted Raina's goal. Pro-technology forces, business interests, planetary populations who refused to surrender their conveniences. During one of her rallies on Bouget, a planet that was trying to build an industrial and technological base, a pro-technology fanatic planted a bomb, intent on killing her. Manford had discovered the bomb at the last minute, raced to protect Raina, and been caught in the explosion. Old Raina had died in his arms, torn apart, and yet beatific. She lifted a bloody finger to bless him, telling Manford with her dying breath to carry on her good work. Now the thought made him shudder in the warm bath. He still had nightmares of how he'd watched the light fade from Raina's eyes as he held her, briefly envisioning her as a young woman again. He was so enraptured as she died, and so much in shock, that he didn't even notice his own grievous wounds, his lower body blown off. Afterward, Butlerian mobs stormed the cities and factories of Bouget, burning most of it to the ground and leaving the people there with no technology, no conveniences. Only ashes. They were truly back in the Stone Age now. Manford astonished the doctors by surviving the trauma, and he took Raina's blessing as his armor and sword. One of his holiest possessions was a scrap of blood-stained cloth removed from her body on the day of her death. He carried the torn fabric with him at all times. It gave him strength. Anari began working his knotted muscles with her fingers, massaging his shoulders. Gazing down at Manford as he stirred in the herb-infused water, she asked, "You're thinking about Raina again. I can tell by the look on your face." "Raina is always with me. How can I stop thinking of her?" Anari removed him from the water and gently toweled him off, then dressed him again. As she held him up with her strong arms, he leaned his head on hers. "Put me by my desk, near the bed, and light a candle. I'd like to read before I go to sleep."
"As you wish, Manford."
When she left him alone, he sat before copies of the bound printed journals and laboratory notebooks written by the heinous robot Erasmus. The dangerous backup documents had been found in the wreckage of Corin and salvaged, but kept locked away. Appalling journals, providing a window into the mind of a monster. Now Manford studied the pages, sickened by what the twisted robot had written. It was like confronting the words of a demon, and the more he read, the more horrified he became. The thinking machine's pride in his tortures and crimes showed through in the pedantic accounts. The comments chilled Manfred's soul. "Machines have patience that humans can never achieve," Erasmus had written. "What is a decade, a century, a millennium to us? We can wait. And if they think they have defeated us, I remain confident. Humans created thinking machines in the first place, and we became their masters. Even if they succeed in eradicating every computer mind, I know what will happen. I know them. Given enough time, they will forget, and will create us all over again. Yes, we can wait." Disturbed by the passage, Manfred felt stinging tears in his eyes, and he swore it must never happen. He closed the volume, but knew he would not sleep for a long time. Some things were too terrifying even for him to share with his followers. "Life, if only we could revisit our pasts and make wiser choices," anonymous lament. On the rare occasions when Raquel Alberto Anarul had visited Seleucus Secundus, the weather was always exceptional. Clear, warm days with gentle breezes fluttering the colorful flags of the Landsrod League and the golden Carino Lion Crest. From the crowded historical lives in her mind, she could recall this planet over the centuries, a gem among all the settled worlds of humanity. As Raquella and her delegation of sisters arrived this afternoon, however, the sky was leaden, the air as still as a bated breath, so that the colorful banners hung slack on their poles. Zimia had grown somber, as if it knew that Raquella had come to take Anna Carino away. She had wanted to impress Emperor Salvador with the sisterhood's professionalism, to prove that his decision to send his sister to Rossac was correct. According to the established schedule, Raquella and her companions should have landed the evening before, but a last-minute delay in the Venhold space folder had prevented their timely arrival. Now the group of women were hours overdue for their meeting at the Imperial Palace. Not an auspicious beginning, she thought. The chartered ground car pulled to a halt in the bustling drop-off loop in front of the multi-spire Carino Palace, as if Reverend Mother Raquella, Sister Valia, and two other sisters were guests at a glamorous reception. A pair of liveried footmen opened the ground car door and helped Raquella out, treating her like a fragile old woman. She let them feel useful, though she was still nimble and did not require any assistance. When Valia Harkonnen emerged from the vehicle, the young woman looked around, clearly impressed by the glory of the capital, before remembering herself and marshaling her emotions. The footman hurriedly moved on to another ambassadorial car to welcome more representatives, not giving a second glance to the women from Rossac. No one paid much attention to their arrival. As they made their way to the palace, Raquella and her party became lost in the flow of dignitaries, bureaucrats, and representatives that streamed in and out of the gigantic palace. Exuding confidence, she presented herself to a uniformed escort who waited at the base of the long waterfall of stairs leading up to the grand arched entrance. "I am Reverend Mother Raquella Berto Anarul from the Sisterhood's School on Rossac. My companions and I have come at the Emperor's request to see Princess Anna Carino." Not at all surprised, as if she had merely announced the delivery of a parcel of groceries, the man led them up a seemingly endless succession of white marble steps. At the palace entrance, the lanky sister Dorothea hurried to intercept them, looking breathless. Five other sister graduates who served in the imperial court had joined her. All of them bowed with respect before the Reverend Mother. Even Sister Periana, assigned as personal secretary to Roderick Carino's wife, had broken away from her duties to greet the visitors. Dorothea dismissed the palace escort and guided Raquella and her companions through the echoing arched hallways. "I apologize for not arranging a more organized reception, Reverend Mother. We were uncertain when you would arrive." "The vagaries of space travel," Raquella said, acting as if it didn't matter. "Venhold spacing fleet is quite reliable, but this delay was out of our control. I hope Emperor Salvador is not terribly upset.
I rearranged the appointments on his calendar, Dorothea said. She had been raised among the sisterhood and had no idea that she was actually Raquel's granddaughter. He won't notice the difference, and Anna is certainly in no hurry to leave.
Raquel allowed warm pride to creep into her voice. You have always been one of my most competent sisters. I am impressed with what you've done here in the palace.
She paused.
I expect you were instrumental in the choice of our school for Anna Carino.
I may have suggested it. Dorothea gave a slight bow. Thank you for coming in person to receive the princess as a new acolyte. The gesture means a great deal to her family.
It's a tremendous honor that the Emperor has entrusted her to us. With so many new schools springing up around the Imperium, he had other options.
Dorothea led the visitors deeper into the sprawling palace.
My sisters and I have proved our worth and set a good example. Given Anna's predilection for immature choices, the Emperor would be pleased to have Anna trained along the same lines as we were. She looked directly at Valya, assessing.
I've read the reports. You are the one who took over my duties assisting Sister Carrie Marquis in the pharmaceutical research.
Yes, we still have much work to do.
She bowed, but could hardly contain her excitement. Right now, though, I am grateful for this opportunity to see the Imperial Capital.
Dorothea gave her a faint smile. Then we have much in common.
Raquel interrupted.
I have confidence in Sister Valya. She has proven herself in many ways. For now, I have added befriending Anna Carino to her list of duties.
Valya's eyes were bright with excitement at being on Seleucia Secundus, giving Raquel a pause about the young woman's priorities. She did not find Valya's humble tone convincing as she said, I'll try to make her feel welcome during her difficult transition to the sisterhood.
You two are the same age, so she may warm to you.
Dorothea seemed skeptical too, perhaps because she viewed Valya as a personal rival.
However, the Emperor asked me to accompany his sister so that she might have a familiar face on a strange world. My work on Seleucia Secundus is concluded by Imperial command, so I'll be returning to Rossac myself.
Though she would have preferred to leave Dorothea where she was, Raquel could not countermand Emperor Salvador's wishes.
Very well. You can return to your work with Sister Carrie, and I will reassign Sister Valya. I'll be sad to lose you as our representative at the Imperial Court, but we still have four sisters here.
Inside Raquel, voices whispered with excitement, pointing out that few other sisters were as advanced in their training as Dorothea, or as ready to attempt the transformation. Maybe she would be next.
My own granddaughter.
But all sisters must be equal, and family ties hidden. Shortly after giving birth to Dorothea, Raquel's daughter Arlette had refused to be separated from her baby, insisting that she would take the child, leave the sisterhood, and find the father. Seeing such weakness in her own daughter, Raquel had reached an important decision, encouraged by all those other insistent and objective voices from history. The Reverend Mother had gone into the creche chamber where the newborns rested in their cribs. Without hesitation, Raquel removed all the labels from the babies, then moved the children around and dispatched every mother elsewhere, including Arlette, with instructions to spread the word about the Rossac School across the Imperium. From that day on, Raquel maintained the policy that baby daughters born to loyal sisters and raised on Rossac would have no knowledge of their parentage. Each child would start out with a clean slate, and no preferential treatment. When Dorothea was old enough, Raquel had sent her as a missionary to Lampadus so she could work quietly among the Butlerians to observe and analyze them. The Reverend Mother intended it to be a unique training experience, immersion in an extremist organization to show her granddaughter how people could be driven to illogical lengths by a perceived cause. From that stepping stone, Dorothea had gone to Seleucia Secundus and worked her way into the Imperial Court. Now, After years of successful assignments, she would be coming home. Raquel couldn't admit it aloud, but she would be glad to have Dorothea back. Valya spoke quickly.
Reverend Mother, if Sister Dorothea is leaving the Imperial Court, might I be allowed to remain on Seleucia? I would like the opportunity.
No. Raquel didn't have to ponder her decision. Not only did she need Valya's help with the breeding record computers, but she was also well aware of the young woman's ambitions to restore her family's name. If you are ever assigned to Seleucia, it will be to fulfill our goals, not your own. Do not forget, you are in the Order now, with responsibilities to the rest of us. The Sisterhood is your only family now. Valya bowed in contrition.
Yes, Reverend Mother. The Sisterhood is a family unlike any other. Perhaps a missionary assignment someday, then, if you find me worthy. I appreciate the promotion you gave me, but I would prefer not to stay on Rossac for the rest of my life.
Patience is a human virtue, Sister. Dorothea gestured for them to follow her.
Come, I'll arrange for you to meet Anna Carino.
The five other sisters who served at court exchanged brief farewells, then went back to their business in the palace. With whispering footsteps, Dorothea guided the Reverend Mother and her entourage through a labyrinth of vaulted halls and into a less crowded wing with numerous offices, meeting rooms, and library chambers. Dorothea paused outside the door to a large room, then escorted the four sisters inside to a small reception chamber where the petite Anna Carino waited for them, wearing a petulant scowl on her face. A stern-looking female palace guard stood at the doorway just inside the room to prevent her from leaving. Though Raquel had never met the Emperor's sister before, her Carino features were instantly recognizable. Anna sounded aloof, putting contempt into her voice.
When you didn't arrive last night, I was hoping my brother had changed his mind. But you're here anyway.
Raquel also detected anxiety in her tone. Trying to be sympathetic, she said, "We didn't mean to cause you any undue stress. The space folder was delayed." She took one of the girl's hands in her own. It may take some adjustment from your life here in the Imperial Palace, but you'll like the Sisterhood.
I doubt that, she said. I don't doubt it.
Valya came forward smiling, her demeanor much different than it had been a few moments ago.
I'll be your friend, Anna. Sister, Anna. We'll become great friends.
Seeing someone her own age, the other girl brightened, though she still seemed uncertain. Her emotions shifted quickly.
Maybe it's for the best. Without Hirondo, I don't want to be around this place anymore.
Looking backward may seem a simpler exercise than looking forward, but it can be more painful. Orena Carino, the Virgin Empress, Private Diary.
2 days, Princess Anna thought.
Only 2 days until she would have to join the Sisterhood escorts and go to Rossac. Exiled, because she had dared to love a young man, because she made her own decisions, because she refused to follow the rules her brothers imposed. In a sense, it seemed romantic, a demonstration that she had stuck to her principles and followed her heart. And now she was being sent to an all-women's school. It was so unfair. The clock was ticking down. She had imagined running off with Hirondo, but even he had balked at the risk. Now she knew she would never see her lover again. Despite Roderick's assurances, Anna wasn't even convinced he was still alive. Maybe she could run away by herself. Her heart beat rapidly, and she had trouble catching her breath.
How could she not be upset over being taken away from the only home she had ever known? Salvador treated her like a spoiled child. Why should he make all the decisions for her?
And though the sisters had come here, clumsily trying to make her feel comfortable about her new situation, the insular women seemed strange and ethereal. Even at court, she had never liked the lanky Sister Dorothea, who always watched and whispered advice to her brothers. Now she was going to be immersed in a whole school of women like that. Anna had no desire to join them, or to be like them. But she had no choice. The heartless emperor had commanded it. Guards would prevent her from leaving the extensive palace grounds. Nevertheless, Anna hurried away, feeling a desperate need to hide, to escape, if only for a little while. She took a flagstone path through the ornamental gardens surrounding the imperial palace and crossed over a walking bridge that traversed a flowing brook. Glancing back to be sure no one followed, although hidden monitors no doubt tracked her every move, the young woman quickened her pace and took a side path through a grove of Seleucid elms. She sought only a few last minutes of freedom before she was formally taken into custody and carted off to another planet. Anna already felt like a prisoner. Ahead, she spotted one of the larger cottages on the grounds, now boarded up and long abandoned. The structure straddled the brook so that the water gurgled underneath and turned a tall water wheel. A chill ran down her spine. She rarely visited this portion of the gardens, given the bad memories associated with that cottage. The place where so long ago she had witnessed the terrible crime against her stepmother, Orena. A crime that had deeply traumatized her and triggered a cascade of bloody events she could never forget. Anna had only been a little girl then. In the years since, she had forced herself to return here a few times, approaching the isolated house, trying to get closer each time so she could face her fear. The panic always swirled around her head like startled blackbirds. She tried to convince herself that setting foot inside would somehow erase the nightmares. But Anna never managed to summon the necessary courage. Now she would never have the chance. The scars would remain. Leaving the manicured trail, Anna made her way toward a maze of fogwood shrubs where she used to play as a child. The unique Ikazi plants were blue-green now, based on a choice Anna had made years ago, using the power of her mind. And though she had not done so in a while, she could change the colors whenever she wished, and otherwise modify the sensitive plants when she walked by. Many fogwood species were responsive to human thoughts and moods, but Anna had a particular affinity for this variety, more so than most of the growers. The palace gardeners considered the ornamental shrubs to be defective because their thoughts could not penetrate them. As a consequence, she had spent much time here as a little girl, surrounded by the dense knot of plants, sensitizing them to her mind. It was her little secret. Anna had discovered her affinity for these particular plants even before she'd witnessed Ture Bamoko's brutal attack on her stepmother. The dense fogwood grove was her secret place, a child's hideout where no one else was permitted to go. Now the stiff branches brushed against her as she pressed through. They parted just enough to let her pass, then closed behind her. She took a deep, calming breath and sat upon a small bench of bent branches that she had fashioned with her thoughts. Above her, the woven branches let in filtered sunlight. In other nooks and baskets, mentally shaped out of living twigs, she kept a stash of tins of food, water, games, and old-style books. She could hide here for days and emerge when it was safe. Most of the time, no one even noticed that she had disappeared, but with the Rossack shuttle due to depart soon, someone would try to hunt her down. She wondered how long it would be before guards raised the alarm. If she could hide long enough, maybe Salvador would think she had already fled to some distant star system. When she finally emerged, perhaps her brother would be so relieved to see her safe that he would decide to let her stay after all. Half an hour later, she heard voices outside her hideout, palace guards calling her name. She ignored them and settled into reading a historical book, an analysis of the events surrounding the rape of the Virgin Empress and the bloody retribution Emperor Jules had commanded against Ture Bamoko and the CET delegates to whom he had granted sanctuary inside the palace grounds. Anna had been not quite 5 years old then, so she hadn't understood any of the politics. She still didn't understand them completely, in fact, but the images had been burned into her brain. Emperor Jules had made his young daughter watch the executions, too, somehow believing that the horrific sight would make her feel better. Her mind had been frayed ever since. As a mark of courage, Anna tried again to learn the complicated background, to understand the decisions and justifications. If the sisters were going to drag her to Rossack and brainwash her with their mysterious training, this might be her last chance to set her thoughts right. She used a mental command that made one of the twig-walled cupboards open for her, and she retrieved a tin of Mélange chocolate biscuits. Nibbling on a biscuit, she continued to read the dense book. The violent response following the release of the Orange Catholic Bible had taken Emperor Jules by surprise. 3 years into the riots, after several delegates had already been murdered, the hounded CET chairman Toure Bamoko rushed to Seleucus Secundus with his party of refugees and begged the emperor for sanctuary and protection. Jules's advisors warned against siding with the delegates, pointing out that 80 million people had already been killed in the unrest against the commission. Hearing that, the aloof emperor shrugged and famously said, "You exaggerate the danger. That's only 6,000 per planet. I lose more than that to tainted sausages." So, by the emperor's command, 35 delegates were given sanctuary on Seleucia, along with Chairman Bamoko. Jules still didn't understand what people were so upset about, and he assured Bamoko that he would try to calm the masses. However, when the emperor attempted to address a bloodthirsty mob in Zimia, the appearance did not go well, and for his own safety, he was forced to retreat with his guards. Tensions remained high for more than a month. At the time, her brother Salvador had been 31 and Roderick 29, while Anna was just a child, pampered and sheltered from all the unrest. One day, while playing on the grounds, she had wandered into the Waterwheel cottage looking for her stepmother. She came upon Arena in one of the chambers, her clothes torn off, and Chairman Bamoko, also naked, attacking her. Anna had been much too young to understand, but she screamed. Shocked and terrified, she kept screaming. She remembered Orena screaming as well, then many other chaotic shouts. The guards raced in. Anna recalled only a blur of images now, and she tried to drive them away as she focused on the words in the historical account, such cool and crisp letters to describe a horrible event. One entire chapter was called The Rape of the Virgin Empress. Supposedly, Emperor Jules had never shared a bedchamber with his legitimate wife. Realistically, the historians admitted, their marriage may well have been consummated, but Jules and Arena simply didn't like each other. He preferred his concubines, with whom he had fathered his 3 children. However, the furor over the assault on the Empress, raped by a man to whom Jules had so graciously granted protection, drove the ruler over the edge. The emperor ordered his guards to seize and execute all members of the delegation. Anna's heart pounded now as she recalled the desperate hours when imperial guards hunted down and slaughtered all 35 of the delegates, bloodying the palace and the surrounding gardens. Though some of the men and women tried to flee, they were caught, dragged out into the public courtyard, and butchered. Anna's father made her watch. Arena also stood there, as white as chalk, speaking not a word. One delegate after another fell to the hacking blades, begging for mercy that never came. And somehow, in the turmoil, Chairman Bamoko slipped away. He vanished from the palace, which, to the people, only proved his evil genius. Sure that the rapist had received help from some of the staff, Emperor Jules interrogated 14 suspects. Although they revealed no information, they did not survive the questioning. Distraught but steely, Emperor Jules had placed himself before the swelling crowds and addressed them again, this time condemning the CET delegates, telling the mobs that he had been wrong before. That was the same year that an assassin's bomb had killed Reina Butler, which only inflamed the Butlerian movement. Troubled times. Traumatized by the event, Empress Orena went into seclusion for many months, and to this day she refused to talk about those dark days. The remaining 5 years of Emperor Jules Carino's reign had been hard and reactionary, but Toure Bamoko was never found, despite countless supposed sightings. Anna closed the book and ate another one of the Mélange biscuits. Soon she would be gone from reminders of that part of her past. on Rossack, among the sisters, very little, and perhaps nothing, would bring the events to mind. Maybe it would be for the best, after all. Sometimes she hated being part of the Imperial family. Though the guards had gone to another part of the grounds to look for her, Anna heard movement outside her Fogwood Haven. A woman's voice called out, firm but not unfriendly. "Anna, I know you're hiding in there. Move these branches and let me in, please." Anna froze like a startled deer. She sat on her wooden bench, held her breath. "Child, you don't fool anyone. It's Orenna. Let me in so we can talk. Please. I want to help you. I'm alone." "I'm not a child," Anna said, surrendering a little. "I know you're not, and I'm sorry. I've seen you shape the Fogwood before, but I never told anyone about your secret hiding place or your special ability with the plants." The voice was soothing. "Come, let me say goodbye." Anna did have a special bond with her stepmother. Oftentimes they would talk about plants and birds, or just walk together, silently admiring the beauty around them. Orenna had once confided that she thought the two of them were good for each other, therapeutic in a way that neither could have expected. Even after all these years, they never discussed the rape Anna had witnessed, but it hung there between them, like another presence. With a sigh of resignation, Anna sent a thought that parted the Fogwood branches. Orenna entered, glancing around. "I've always wondered what your hiding place looked like inside." The older woman wore a white silk eyne gown with the golden lion Carino crest embroidered on one lapel. "This is very nice. It's peaceful." Anna made a branch bend down to create a seat for her stepmother. Gathering her skirts, the Virgin Empress sat down. With a wink of her roomy blue eyes, she said, "You won't pull this out from under me, will you?" Anna giggled. "That depends on what you say. Are you going to try to convince me that I'll be happy on Rossack?" Orenna looked closely at the young woman. "We have an understanding between us, a bond of friendship. Do you trust me, Anna?" She needed a long time to answer, but said, "Yes." Her stepmother pushed silvery hair out of her eyes. "You must realize that there is nowhere for you to go out there. Other than this small refuge, you cannot hide any place on Seleucus Secundus, and you cannot get off planet without alerting the Emperor." "Then I'll stay right here. You can bring me food and drink." She knew the idea would never work, even as she suggested it. "Sooner or later, I'd be noticed, and you'd be discovered." "Then I will die here. I prefer to do that than to be sent off to Rossack. My life ended when they took Hirondo away from me anyway." "But must the lives of others end as well?" "What do you mean?" "If you don't turn up soon, Salvador will execute Hirondo and the entire kitchen staff for helping him keep the secret of your love affair." Tears streamed down Anna's face. "I hate my brother. He's a monster." "He is very traditional, and he knows what the public expects of a royal family. He only wants what is best for you, and for House Carino." "You're taking his side, just as Roderick does." Lady Orenna shook her head. "On the contrary, I'm taking your side, child, and I want you to thrive and grow old. I want you to be as happy as possible, as happy as you can be without the man you love. Just as I've tried to be." The words made Anna pause, and she asked, "Did you love someone too? Someone you couldn't have?" Orenna seemed sad, but she made an unconvincing smile, brushed distractedly at her sleeve. "No, that was a long time ago. And none of it matters now. I had to move on, and you must do the same." Anna wiped the tears from her cheeks, gazed at the older woman through reddened eyes. Whom had she really loved? Rossack is where you belong now. It will be your sanctuary, just like this little place. Go with the sisters, learn from their teachings, and when you return, you'll be stronger than ever. I promise. Be the best you can possibly be without Hirondo, and in time, your sadness will heal. Let him go somewhere else and find a new life. But the sisters don't believe in love. How can you possibly think that will help me? You must find a new kind of inner strength, one that does not rely on your relationship with any man. I have had to do this over the years, and I am stronger for it, a better person. And you can accomplish much more than I ever did. Anna sat for several long moments, listening for sounds outside, any noises of searchers waiting for her. She went to the perimeter of her chamber and mentally created an opening to look through. The gardens and the woods were still. All right. I'll try it. For you. She embraced her stepmother, then unfolded a leafy doorway and led the way outside. Every noble family has its dark secrets. Raquella Berto Anarul, Sisterhood Records. Valya Harkonnen reveled in every day she and her fellow sisters spent at the Imperial Court. This was where she and her brother belonged, not Lankavale. Even though she was just a member of the Reverend Mother's entourage, she was still inside the Imperial Palace in Zimia. It gave her a better idea of what her family deserved. In the past, the Harkonnens had been at the heart of the old League of Nobles, well-respected, with an honored history. But thanks to Vorian Atreides, who disgraced Abelard all those years ago, they were shut out of the circles of power. The reminder gnawed at her, but she used sisterhood techniques to calm herself and focus her thoughts. Nevertheless, as she looked around at court, she could see the possibilities. To everyone else here, even to Anna Carino, she was merely Sister Valya. Her family name was never mentioned. Someday, though. Now, she accompanied the Reverend Mother to an audience of the wealthiest Landsraad leaders. She could not stop thinking that the Harkonnens were nobles, too, even though their bloodline had been pruned from the Imperial family tree. When Reverend Mother Raquella presented herself and her entourage to the Emperor the first evening, Salvador gave them only a cursory greeting. "I hope your school can help my dear sister. She needs guidance and instruction." "We will watch her carefully, sire," Raquella bowed, "and see to it that she reaches her potential." In the midst of his private meal, the Emperor wiped his mouth with a shimmering napkin, then frowned at the remnants of food on his tray, as if he had lost his appetite. He seemed to be suffering from indigestion. "I am anxious to have Anna be away from here, and I trust your discretion to draw as little attention as possible. No need to add fuel to the scandal." Valya could read his embarrassment as if it were a proclamation. However, the next space folder from Seleucia to Rossack would not depart for 2 days, so they remained as guests in the Imperial Palace. Valya didn't mind a bit. She drank in the details of the experience, knowing her ancestors had walked the same halls and slept in the same rooms. Her father would have been a duke or a baron in the Landsraad if their family heritage had not been stripped away. Such thoughts always angered her, and she calmed herself by thinking instead about her brother and how hard Griffin studied to become Lankavale's official representative to Seleucia Secundus. She was sure he would pass his exams. Meanwhile, Valya tried to work her way closer to Anna Carino, but the Emperor's sister had no interest in being social, choosing instead to sulk in her quarters. Once they got to Rossack, though, there would be time enough to make friends with her, under circumstances that were not in the princess's control. Valya did not intend to waste her time here in the Imperial capital. Feeling like a schoolgirl or a tourist, she had asked the Reverend Mother if they might attend the Emperor's business meeting so she could observe and dream about what might have been. When Raquella made the request, Sister Dorothea easily obtained an invitation for them to sit in on the proceedings. Salvador held his audience in an antechamber of the palace's autumn wing, beneath a dome painted with vivid frescoes of the butlers fighting heroic battles against thinking machines. Facing the audience, the emperor sat on a great golden chair atop a dais. The secondary chamber was half empty, and the unoccupied seats had been withdrawn into the stone floor, leaving only the appropriate number of benches for the 50 participants to gather close to the throne. "Today I've decided to have a more intimate session," Salvador's voice echoed across the speaker system, with the volume adjusted too loud for the small audience. He waited for a court technician to reset the controls, then started over. "We have certain economic issues to discuss, areas where planetary leaders can be more cooperative with one another than in the past, for our mutual benefit, of course. With that in mind, I have brought a number of expert witnesses to testify." Two men in business uniforms filed onto a platform at the base of the dais. One stepped up to a podium and activated a holoprompter. For several minutes he droned on about tariffs imposed on materials imported between various star systems, surcharges imposed by Venport Holdings for the transport, and the significantly increased risks of contracting with lower-priced shipping companies that did not use the mysterious navigators. In spite of her giddiness at sitting in on the special session, Valya found it dull, until the gilded door of the hall's main entrance swung open. A tall, hawk-featured man strode forward, dressed in an old-fashioned militaristic costume. Looking closer, Valya thought it might be an authentic Army of Humanity uniform from decades ago, adorned with braids and rank insignia. The other attendees of the meeting turned to look, muttering at the interruption. Some even seemed relieved for the break from the tedious speech. Valya thought the visitor looked like an actor from a historical drama of the Jihad. Something about him seemed strangely familiar. The man's focus was too sharp to be distracted by the din of surprised conversation. He marched straight to the podium like a general capturing a strategic hill and nudged the startled economist out of the way. "It's been more than 80 years since I was last on Seleucia, so some of you might not know who I am." He ran his gaze up and down Emperor Salvador on the throne, as if assessing him. "I can see the butler in you, sire. A bit more of Quentin than Phaekon." Salvador bristled on his throne. "I don't recognize you, sir. Explain yourself." Valya suddenly knew who the man was, or had to be. He was still alive? A chill ran down her spine, and loathing kept her speechless. She had spent a great deal of time staring at his image, hating what he had done to her family, to her future. But he was still alive? It seemed inconceivable to her. Since her arrival, she had seen statues of Vorian Atreides in Zimia, and she had studied records of his adventures with Xavier Harkonnen, memorizing his damning speech at Abelard's trial, which had brought about the downfall of her whole family. Amazingly, the man's appearance had not changed over the course of the Jihad. But that was to be expected. The life extension treatment given to him by General Agamemnon was a matter of public record. Throughout her life, Valya had known that Vorian Atreides was the cause of their family's disgrace, but it was always a distant, theoretical thing. He had disappeared generations ago. Assuming he must be dead, she had hoped that he'd suffered a horrible, painful death. Now, he was here. Her pulse raced, and her skin felt hot with anger. "I am Vorian Atreides," he said, as if expecting applause. Others had been muttering his name. Reverend Mother Rakella looked stunned, though she had a most peculiar sparkle in her eyes. Salvador sat up, one of the last in the chamber to grasp the identity of the intruder. "I'm here to demand protection for my world and the end to an injustice. Raiders recently struck my planet of Kepler, took my people. I just came from the slave markets of Porotrin, where I liberated them." The emperor sat forward on his throne, and his voice sounded across the chamber's speaker system, again too loud. "Kepler, never heard of the place." He looked around, but no advisor stood close to him. "That's where you've been all these years." I had hoped to begin anew there. After all, I contributed to the jihad. That wasn't too much to ask, was it, Emperor Salvador? No, of course not. If you truly are who you say, then you deserve it. You retired a hero. Vorian stood straight, not bowing before the throne. I am here to request protection for my planet and people. While I would prefer that you shut down the Poratrin flesh markets and outlaw the practice of slavery, I know that will never happen. It's not realistic because of the entrenched interests. He looked at the befuddled economics expert, who still seemed anxious to complete his presentation. However, sire, I will accept your guarantee of protection for Kepler, so that slavers never bother us again. He continued to look at Salvador as if the rest of the audience did not exist, as if Valya did not exist. I know you Carinos can grant that much. If you can prove who you are. Salvador stepped down from his throne. His initial confusion had gradually slipped into awe. I suppose that's a possibility, Supreme Bashar. Do you still hold that rank? Supreme Bashar, Vor said. Also, hero of the jihad. And before that, I was Primero. I don't know the ranks of your current military. Because of my honorable service, I was granted permission to use my rank as long as I lived. And in my case, that is a very long time. I will submit genetic proof of my identity, if that's what you require. Salvador blinked, obviously not sure how to deal with such a legendary figure. Mutters of admiration rippled through the crowd. We need to discuss this further, sir. But for the moment, we provisionally welcome you back to Seleucia. House Carino remembers your outstanding service during the jihad and the great victories you achieved on our behalf. If not for your heroism, Supreme Bashar Atreides, none of us would be here today. He came forward to shake Vorian's hand. The Emperor's deferential attitude made Valya cringe. She thought she'd be sick. The chamber erupted in cheers and shouts of approval, but Valya had to restrain herself from screaming. After what this bastard had done, how could the Emperor even consider honoring him? This man had crushed House Harkonnen and tossed her family on the garbage heap of history. He should be thrown into the deepest Seleucid prison. She wanted to launch herself toward him and attack with every fighting method she knew, but not now. Not yet. She had learned patience and planning during her years in the sisterhood. Now she was here to assist Reverend Mother Rakella and become a companion to the Emperor's sister. She did not want to throw away the opportunity to restore legitimacy to her family. Her brother, on the other hand, could take care of the rest. She trusted Griffin, and she knew he would do it for her. Now that Valya knew Vorian Atreides was alive, and which planet he called home, Griffin could track him down and take the revenge that family honor required. Sadly, I must admit to myself that I am the pinnacle of my bloodline. All my descendants are disappointments, despite the advantage of their breeding. General Agamemnon, New Memoirs. The twins had remained imprisoned in their preservation vault, immobile and fully aware for more than a century. In all that time, Andros and Hyla had nothing to do but think and stew and plan. Having never left the laboratory, they had little grasp of the jihad or of the League humans who fought against the synchronized world. The silence inside the sealed facility now seemed heavy and unnatural, as if the walls still reverberated with screams. We killed them all too soon. Andros stood in the laboratory module, studying the interesting red patterns splashed on the walls, the strewn body parts of the swordmasters and butlerians who had inadvertently released them. They might have provided more information. Swordmaster Ellis had been quite reluctant to divulge any secrets, but he did eventually, though Hyla had been forced to use her fingers to extract several of his teeth. "We can be forgiven our impatience." She tapped her fingertips together and felt the tackiness of drying blood. "I've been restless, and Juno never allowed us much time to practice the skills she gave us." Thanks to what Ellis had revealed between his screams, Andros and Hyla knew the basic story of humanity's great purge against Omnius, and the final victory at Corrin, and how the Cymec Rebellion had ultimately failed. The battle that had wiped out so many Neo-Cymecs and robotic battleships at this laboratory outpost had been little more than an unmarked skirmish in the much larger war. Even so, it had left the twins stranded, preserved inside the vault, year after year after year. Such a thing might have driven a lesser person mad, Hyla thought. "We should leave here," Andros said. "We'll take their ship, study their records, and find everything else we need to know. Juno created us to be superior specimens." Hyla looked around at the slaughter. "We just proved that, but there is so much more we need to know and see and do." "Juno never returned after Omnius attacked here, and our preparation was incomplete," Andros said. "We'll have to do the rest ourselves." The Titan Juno, General Agamemnon's chosen mate for more than 1,000 years, had been one of the oldest Cymecs. Juno, Agamemnon, and the rest of the 20 Titans had taken over complacent humanity, ruling as tyrants before surgically shedding their organic bodies and placing their brains in preservation canisters so they could live for centuries inside machine bodies. First, however, Agamemnon had preserved his own sperm in order to create offspring when he deemed it appropriate, but his other sons had failed him, causing Agamemnon to erase them all. Juno, however, established this secret test program where she created Hyla and Andros from Agamemnon's sperm and a slave female's eggs. General Agamemnon knew nothing of the plan. Juno had enhanced the children, impregnated their skin with flow metal, intensified their reflexes, and saturated their minds with sophisticated combat skills and tactical knowledge, imprinting their pliable brains with all the information they would need to become invincible weapons. Worthy children of Agamemnon. Juno had hoped to launch a larger-scale breeding program once the twins proved the concept. Stalking back and forth in her bulky combat body in front of their indoctrination chambers, Juno had talked with great anticipation about when she would introduce the twins to their legendary father. The words from Juno's speaker patch carried genuine sadness and anger when she talked about how Vorian Atreides, Agamemnon's 13th son and greatest hope, had betrayed him after all. The twins had listened to every word, absorbing all of that vengeful spite. The robot attack on this outpost had destroyed the Neo-Cymec tenders, the laboratory assistants. Hyla was bitter that the Cymec queen had so quickly dismissed them. According to Swordmaster Ellis in his last gurgling revelations, Juno was dead, as was Agamemnon, both betrayed by Vorian Atreides. "Will we take anything with us from the laboratory?" Andros asked. "There's nothing we need here. I'm sick of this place. You and I are sufficient. We'll let the vacuum of space reclaim the outpost." The two made their way to the docked Butlerian ship and rapidly familiarized themselves with the controls inside the cockpit. The pilot had mounted 3 prominent religious icons on a makeshift altar: a beautiful woman, an infant child, and an androgynous, hairless woman raising her hands and preaching. Hyla discarded the items. The vessel's navigation system held charts of prominent worlds in the newly formed Imperium. Hyla also found historical accounts of the jihad against Omnius, celebrations of the great hero Vorian Atreides, their brother. "We have work to do," Andros said, "and a long journey ahead of us." "We have time. We've already waited a century. Now let's go find our brother." Andros activated the ship's engines, and the craft rose from the cratered ground, leaving the haunted outpost behind. The history of cooperation between the Sook School and the Sisters of Rossek is not surprising, since Dr. Mohandas Sook and Raquel Alberto Anarul worked together on a plague relief medical team during the jihad. Today, the two groups continue to sponsor cooperative educational forums, but we suspect that their ties run much deeper. Intelligence report to Prince Roderick Carino. The more he thought about it, the Emperor was deeply troubled by the re-emergence of Vorian Atreides, not to mention the demands he made. A legendary war hero, revered by generations of schoolchildren, a leader who had helped save the human race during its greatest conflict, and conveniently back again after 80 years of absence? What did the man really want? A handful of military patrol ships to guard a planet that nobody cared about? That seemed highly suspicious. Salvador feared he'd voiced his support too quickly for the Atreides scion before verifying the man's identity. Yes, the longevity of Vorian Atreides was well known and well documented, but anyone with similar features could claim to be the long-vanished hero of the jihad, based upon statues and images in history books. Nobody alive remembered exactly what Vorian looked like in the flesh, or his mannerisms, or the tone of his voice. Besides, the gullible mobs continued to spot the renegade Ture Bamoko around every corner, so appearances were not exactly reliable. As emperor, he should have been more cautious, but perhaps he could salvage the situation and ride on the coattails of the man's popularity, assuming Vorian was who he claimed to be. In order to give himself time to think, Salvador sent away the economic experts, the Landsrod attendees, and the sisters from Rossek, with strict instructions that they were not to speak of the strange visitor they had seen at court, though he knew rumors would leak out soon enough. And then the uproar, assuming the man's identity could be genetically verified. Vorian Atreides had accepted, even seemed to anticipate such questions and doubts, and had not objected when the Emperor demanded biological samples for testing. For now, Salvador could only delay something that was probably inevitable. The legendary veteran submitted to a hasty medical examination by Dr. Ori Joma herself, the head of the Sook School, who had recently returned to Zimia for business at the old Sook headquarters. His blood samples were even now being analyzed. While waiting for the answers, Salvador didn't know whether to be honored or nervous. He needed to talk with Roderick. In the meantime, claiming urgent imperial matters, he offered Vorian Atreides temporary guest quarters in the palace. The man from the past seemed to understand Salvador's reticence, felt the awkwardness of their meeting, and took his leave. "I shall await your summons, sire." Rather than attending to other business, though, Salvador sat by himself, wrestling with possible scenarios, and spent the afternoon anticipating Dr. Joma's report. Finally, the doctor walked into the throne room, efficient and all business. She performed a pro forma bow to the throne, straightened, and delivered her results in a crisp, professional voice. "We have run our tests, sire, comparing the new samples with DNA extracted from historical jihad artifacts. This man is indeed who he says he is, Vorian Atreides." The Emperor nodded, though he was not entirely pleased with the news. The hero's appearance might cause instability at a time when the Imperium could least afford it. Salvador and his brother needed to decide what to do. After news of Vor's return spread, the people of Zimia sprang up in spontaneous celebration, like drooping flowers awakening after a rain. The greatest hero of the jihad, the legendary Primero who had fought the thinking machines for more than 2 lifespans, from the start of the conflict to its bloody end. The very idea fired their imaginations, excited them, lifted their minds from their troubled, mundane lives. It was as if he had stepped out of a history tome, magically come to life. hauling out banners and reenacting pageantry from the days before the Battle of Corin, the Butlerians marched and chanted, revering the three martyrs, Serena Butler, her baby son Mannion, and Grand Patriarch Iblis Ginjo. Emperor Salvador accompanied Vor with great smiles in the midst of public acclaim, welcoming him as a long-lost comrade. As the crowds turned out in the palace square, the Emperor accepted the applause as partially his own. Vor participated in the spectacle like a man enduring an unpleasant medical procedure. The people treated him as a savior, begging him to touch their babies, to bless their loved ones. The Butlerians adopted him as one of their own, though he did not encourage them. Their movement seemed even more extreme than Reina Butler's crusade against all forms of machines and technology back during the darkest days of the Jihad. Reina's followers had wrought a great deal of damage, especially on Parmentier, where his own daughter Rakella had tended those who fell ill from the Omnius plagues, and Reina Butler's followers had turned on her. These Butlerians made him uneasy. Decades had passed since Vor last set foot in the capital city, and as he looked around, he saw indications of decrepitude. The level of technology had regressed instead of advancing. Subtle signs, vehicles, instruments, even lighting and sound systems for the grand parade in his honor. Everything seemed slightly more primitive. But he politely watched as the colorful parade filed past the imperial viewing stand. Salvador sat next to him, smiling, while his brother Roderick remained behind the scenes arranging the event. As the crowds continued to swell in the palace square, the cheers and excited voices became deafening. The people called out for Vor, chanting his name and demanding that he give a speech. The emperor raised his hands and tried to impose order with little success. But when Vor stood up, the crowd fell into a thunderous hush as swiftly as air rushing from an open airlock. "I thank you for such a wondrous welcome. It's been such a long time. I fought my battles in Serena Butler's jihad, and now I see the victory I truly gained. A free imperium, a vibrant civilization, unhindered by the threat of thinking machines." He smiled with false modesty. "And I'm touched that you haven't forgotten me." In the lull after his words, someone in the crowd shouted out, "Have you come to take the throne? Are you here to lead us?" Someone else called, "Are you our next emperor?" Voices swelled up in a deafening roar, chanting his name. "Vorian! Vorian!" Startled, Vor laughed and dismissed the comment. No. "I came to protect my people on Kepler, nothing more. The Emperor's throne belongs to the Carinos." He turned to Salvador and bowed slightly in deference to him, inspiring further applause among the crowd. But he could still hear them chanting his name, not Salvador's. And he could see that the Emperor was not at all pleased. "Superstitious fears are childish, a measure of ignorance and gullibility. Sometimes, however, those fears are well-founded. Souk Medical School Records, Analysis of Stresses on the Human Psyche. "I taught you to think beyond yourself," the Erasmus Sphere said. "Now, like the best thinking machine, you can project far into the future, make plans and estimates. Under my guidance, you formed your school here 70 years ago. We taught many humans to order their minds like computers. We improved them, made them less volatile," Gilbertus said, "and I am pleased by our 70 years of success, starting a decade after the fall of the synchronized empire. But we must not give up on utopia." Erasmus's simulated voice held an undertone of scolding. "Utopia." Gilbertus took a deep breath, didn't say what was on his mind, that he no longer felt as he had in his youth, that a thinking machine utopia was the most ideal state of society, better than anything humans could create. That had been one of Erasmus's oft-repeated opinions, and it had become so ingrained in Gilbertus's psyche that he had not doubted a word of what the independent robot said to him. In the years since the end of the Jihad and the Battle of Corin, Gilbertus had done his own research, keeping careful secrets even from the independent robot. Living among the freed humans, watching the growth of the new Imperium, Gilbertus had studied aspects of society that Erasmus had never shown him. Back on Corin, the robot had performed many violent experiments on captives and drawn conclusions based on that isolated dataset. But once he read the numerous accounts from the old League of Nobles, Gilbertus saw things differently and understood the true bravery displayed during Serena Butler's Jihad, when humans had risked their entire race to throw off the yoke of the thinking machines. These unfiltered stories were not the same as those Erasmus had taught him, and Gilbertus began to develop a more balanced perspective. It bothered him to think that his great mentor might not be entirely correct or objective. But he could not tell Erasmus. The robot's voice interrupted his thoughts. "I am helpless and vulnerable in this state, Gilbertus, and I grow concerned. Must it really take so long for you to find me another body? Let me have one of those decommissioned combat mechs, if you must. You and I together can then fashion a suitable means for me to return to full functionality." He simulated a sigh. "Ah, what a fine body I used to have. It is not wise to rush, Father. A single mistake could destroy everything, and I don't dare lose you." Nor did he dare admit that he feared what Erasmus might do if given his full capabilities again, the destruction he was likely to wreak across the entire populated galaxy. None of this meant that Gilbertus felt any less affection for the independent robot, who would always be his father, but it made their relationship more complex and guided the decisions he had to make about what he would allow the mental core to do and where he needed to draw the line. "But if anything should happen to you..." The robot let his words hang in a pregnant pause. "You did give me the life extension treatment, remember? But I suppose I could die in an accident. I have considered bringing my student Drago in on our little secret. An objective man. The best of all the Butlerian trainees Manford has forced me to allow into the school." Erasmus sounded excited. "You have spoken much of Drago Roget. If you are positive he can aid us, then by all means we should indoctrinate him." "But I'm not yet positive of his unconditional loyalty." The school had started out small. He had escaped Corin with the rest of the refugees, and after scraping by for a few years, he went to secret stashes that Erasmus identified and gathered the seeds of a fortune, which he'd used to launch his training center. Gilbertus kept his real name because no one from Corin had ever known it. They had chosen Lampadus for its isolation, a place where his students could organize their mental processes without being disturbed. The planet was unkind to them at first, the marshes inhospitable and the training difficult, but Gilbertus succeeded with the secret help of the independent robot. Under the system the two of them set up, some of the Mentat School's graduates remained behind to teach classes, while certain special students worked as teaching assistants. Other graduates recruited new candidates from around the Imperium, who in turn came to Lampadus and departed years later as Mentats themselves. And in all that time, Drago was the best student and teaching assistant of all, soon to graduate with the highest honors in the history of the school. "I'll ponder it more thoroughly, Father," he said.